All right, Cherry Developer News, episode number 28 for Tuesday, December 7th, 2010. I'm Ken Rimple.
I'm Eric Snyder.
And we're here to talk about all things that we think are interesting in tech. So, Eric, we got a bunch of topics today, all over the map as usual.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we start with some stuff that Amazon's doing? So, they've been putting out, like, just every couple of weeks, they're coming up with a new nice whiz-bang feature. Don't you think? I mean, just cool stuff.
Oh, very cool stuff.
Like the micro instances that was back, I guess, in maybe September, October.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and for people who don't know this, you can run, if you have an Amazon Web Service account, you can run a basic server now for like $15 a month. It's really basic, but you know, if it's like a PHP app that you want to play around with, it's one option. Or if you just want to fire something up for a little bit of time, put a server up and play around with it. It's like 512 megs of RAM, that kind of thing. So very lightweight. But then they entered that, and what else did they come out with? They came out with some other stuff recently too. But oh yeah, like basic monitoring is now free for your applications, and you can take a look in the little tab view in AWS. You can actually get your monitoring statistics of how long it's been up. I don't know, maybe load or something like that. So
right.
Nice stuff. So they just announced, I think it was today or late yesterday, Route 53. I have no idea why it's called Route 53, but it's actually their hosted DNS service in the cloud. I did a quick scan of this. And so it looks like it's a pay-as-you-go model where you go in and say, I want a DNS configuration, and it goes ahead and it builds out, like four different name servers for you, gives you your own zone, and then lets you set up whatever you want in it, either, you know, to host things inside of the cloud or outside of the cloud.
Yeah, it looks like they have nine locations.
Nine,
so
yeah.
US, Europe, Asia.
Right. So you mean cool. In terms of like where they're hosting it, yeah.
Where they're hosting it, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right, and so they've got nice little global kind of distribution of this thing. It's pretty interesting. I mean, they come down to pricing in here. This is an InfoQ article on this by Abel Avram.
And, I think the really cool thing about this is the REST API that they give you to manage the servers.
That's cool.
It is very cool.
Yeah, so that's a good thing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it said something like, in terms of the infrastructure, they say it's $1 a zone a month for the infrastructure hosting. And then, of course, it's by volume. And so their volume is like 50 cents for 1 million queries up to the first billion per month. And then if you have more than a billion queries, congratulations. Hopefully you put ads on there on your sites that you're getting queries and you get some revenue. It's 25 cents. So they drop it down once you hit your first billion for the month.
Okay.
I'm hoping you can monitor that and keep track of it because it seems like an insanely low number, but I don't know what DNS lookups look like in the real world. Like, when would you hit a billion, you know?
Right.
Seems pretty huge number, but I don't know. So anyway, and it says you can get up to 100 hosted zones per account. And then if you want more, you have to contact Amazon. So interesting. And I found out here in the article, the name Route 53 comes from the port UDP 53 used by DNS servers to receive and respond to queries.
That
so there
makes
you go.
Sense, yeah.
Yeah, clearly I don't know my DNS protocol. So anyway, that's an interesting one. It's called Route 53, and now it's available for you on your AWS accounts.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to take one?
Sure. Okay, so recently I've been doing a very small amount of playing around with Scala. Mm-hmm. I tend to revisit, like, it's my annual visitation.
Of new stuff?
Scala.
Or Scala specifically?
Yeah, so I did it last year. Joel Confino, who works for Chariot, and I did a little Lyft project for our Chariot Day, which is our internal conference.
Oh, right, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so I played with Scala and the Lyft framework for, I don't know, a couple of months, and we both had mixed feelings about it. So every year I try and come back to it and see, you know.
Is it ready yet?
I've changed. Scala's changed. Lyft has changed. I ready? Maybe I wasn't ready for Scala.
It wasn't ready for you, or you weren't ready for it. Who knows, right? Yeah.
So anyway, you know, every year I completely forget everything I learned about Scala.
Of course.
So, because I'm not lucky enough to work on a Scala-based project.
Though. Right.
So I found the Scala Language Tour. So, yeah, it's from the Basement Coders.
I love those guys.
Those guys are great.
You guys, big shout out to you.
So there's a video. You know, it's a Vimeo, embedded Vimeo video you can get to the link.
Yeah, Basement Coders, right.
Mm-hmm. But basically, it's a nice long one. It's like an hour and 10 minutes. But basically, it's everything you ever wanted to know about Scala.
Oh, that's awesome.
I mean, starting at not at the very beginning, but kind of, a couple steps from the beginning.
Awesome.
So, you know, it breaks down into categories, and they have an excellent outline, time-stamped outline on the site. So it gets into functional programming, pattern matching, all the cool things that are, you know, not necessarily unique to Scala, but unique in terms of when compared to Java. So closures, you know, how it does OO differently than Java, the way it does generics, duck typing, all that sort of stuff. So if you're a Java developer, even if you're not, you know, this is a great place to maybe not get started, but maybe your second step.
Right. Well, it's cool that they actually, because we had Jonas Bonner, the Eka creator, on the podcast a couple times. It looks like they had him on as well. And, you know, it seems like a lot of it came from there and from another presentation. These guys are great. I actually have to give them a shout out from the podcast side of things. If you don't subscribe to that podcast and you're a developer, you should slap yourself, because they've only had maybe 14 or 15 podcasts, but everyone they've done has been really interesting. I just listened to one on, you know, like, what is the mainframe? What's the relevance of the mainframe for developers these days? And I thought it was a great topic. You know, they pull these topics out that are completely from left field. And, you know, they had two, like, really strong mainframe consultants and developers about, you know, what's going on mainframe platforms. And they say basically, yeah, COBOL's there.
Right.
But there's a lot of stuff being done now in, you know, other languages, even in Java, you know, even with, like, ZOS, basically Linux. And it turns out that when they interpret Linux code, that's a custom dedicated chip on the mainframe that does that.
Yeah, yeah. We made use of that at a client that I was
mm-hmm,
at. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But, so anyway, their basement coders are great. All right, let me grab another one. Here's a product update for you Spring heads out there. So Spring Integration, which is kind of their enterprise integration patterns bus. We had Mark Fisher on the podcast a couple episodes ago to talk about Spring Integration and the forthcoming Integration 2.0. Josh Long just announced an FAQ, an interview with Mark Fisher, that they actually released Spring Integration 2.0 on December 6th. And so there's some nice things that come out of that. Just if you haven't worked with it before, Spring Integration lets you basically take messages in, messages out, and kind of transform them and deal with them in an enterprise messaging pattern. So you might route messages.
So it's sort of on par with like Camel?
Yes, with Camel and with Mule and some other of these other, kind of like an ESB, but it's more like a really lightweight ESB.
Okay.
So if you're developing on Spring and you already have a bunch of Spring developers, this is one way to get enterprise integration into your environment.
Okay.
And so it uses a combination of these XML namespaces in Spring and POJOs, right? Uh-huh. So kind of interesting, really an interesting product if you're a Spring developer and you want to do this. In Spring Integration 2.0, they upgraded to Spring 3, which then gives them Spring Expression Language support. And they're saying that you can actually build your Spring Expression routings within the expression language, and in some cases not even have to write a POJO. So kind of on par with what Mule is doing with things like that. They're doing things like they're actually using Groovy scripts now. So you can put Groovy scripts together for your EIP components. You can trigger events through task scheduling. Another really interesting one is you can wrap aspect-oriented programming language. You can say, you know, whenever this particular method in Java code gets hit, go ahead and send a message to the queue with the data from the parameters or the results or whatever.
Okay.
And you can actually have it so that your code doesn't even have to depend on anything from Spring integration, and automatically would trigger workflows and do things like that. Or I should say trigger message flows.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a really interesting product, Spring Integration 2.0. If you want to find out more information, you go to springsource.org/spring-integration.
Cool.
So do you want to talk about Ruby refinements?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is a proposed Ruby feature. So this is an article on Ruby Inside.
Okay.
And yeah, so I don't want to start any religious wars here. So
why not?
But I might. So, okay. So one of the very, I'm not going to say unusual. Well, I guess it is unusual. But one of the very powerful things that you can do in Ruby is Ruby has open classes. So basically, you can monkey patch classes, you know, at any time. So at runtime. So
adding methods, adding attributes.
Adding methods, changing behavior.
At the instance level, that kind of thing, class level.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, Rails takes full advantage of this. So, you know, Rails has this famous, you know, module, active support module, which basically extends a lot of the Ruby core classes and gives them, you know, in many cases, things that they should have had originally or some really nice things. So, you know, things like you can it extends like a like numbers, like fixed num, where you know, or you can add things to date support. Like you can say 1.days or,
and that's 10 the Rails days. Mix in, so to speak. To
I'm pretty sure Rails, that's an extension that Rails mm-hmm. That active support supply. So, you know, which is great. And, you know, it's great in Rails because the core team, you know, uses it properly. And
right.
Generally is never really an issue. So, but, you know, it really scares the heck out of people. So, especially if you're not, don't have a Ruby background. You, oh, my God, you mean I can just have some gem or library that will completely change the behavior of some core Ruby class? And the answer is yes. And, you know, I can name a couple of situations where that absolutely saved my bacon.
Sure. Yeah.
One is, you know, we had a web application that was very, it's all around scheduling things for television stations. So daylight savings time was a huge issue for us. And the Ruby implementation was, or maybe still is, horribly broken twice a year.
right.
Because
whenever you switch to
whenever you switch, because if you think about it, once a year you have 2 1 o'clocks in the U.S. right, and then once a year you have
don't
no
have
one o'clock.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And so it was, you know, when you would try and schedule some TV program to occur, you know, starting at midnight and going for 3 hours. Sometimes it would work, sometimes it wouldn't. It was actually platform dependent. It behaved differently on Windows. Than
interesting.
On
yeah.
Linux. So, you know, we monkey patched. Time, so we had all these metaphysical discussions. You know, it's like, you know,
did it stitch in time?
Tomorrow is not tomorrow today because right. There's actually a method tomorrow. You know, right. So things would all you know.
So when I'm in this time area where it's flipping, I'm not really able to see.
Yeah,
next
yeah.
hour has to change, kind of that kind of
right, thing. Right. So we used Ruby's open classes to monkey patch mm-hmm. Time.
I have to complain about the Java implementation of time while we're at it.
Yeah.
Hey Oracle, if you're going to be doing anything, either accept JOTA time and make it the law, or please do something about simple time zone, because no matter what, it's not simple.
Right. So, well, you know, from a Java perspective, it's simple.
All I know is that you really had to wrestle with the simple time zone, and then to even test it was interesting. So, you know, and, you know, all sorts of strange things cropped up in terms of the framework support for time and when you get updates to the time zone mm-hmm. database and how you do that.
Oh, yeah. Don't get me started on that.
So, yeah. Time is just tough in general. You're right.
It is.
So, monkey patching. So, anyway. So, back to your discussion.
So, anyway. So, you know, a lot of people fret and worry and pull their hair out because, you know, if you think about it, you can do some real damage. I mean, we had one instance where we included a gem, a gem. It was called Facets. You know, I don't even know if it's used anymore, but at least the version that we included – this was like years ago, but it changed the behavior of array, and it broke array in a really bizarre, unintended way in some really weird corner case somewhere totally different in the system.
Yeah.
We didn't even know it was doing this. So, I mean, that's an example of something
where it can hurt you.
Very scary.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
well, because like nothing uses an array.
Right, exactly.
Nothing uses string. What are you talking about?
Yeah,
here?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So, refinements this proposal anyway is you know, basically scoped extensions.
Okay.
So you have an extension. So you know you have some module and you know, that does something. Monkey patches some core class or one of your own classes or whatever it does. But you don't want it to just apply globally, right? So you can you. Inside of a module in which you want to use that monkey patch, basically,
right?
You just there's a I don't want to call it a keyword because that's still under debate, but you would just say like refine
keyword, yeah,
refine like fix num do, and then you know do I'm thing. Adding this method to fix num,
right?
Something
okay,
like that.
So you're kind of like mixing in that within a namespace.
So basically, you're saying okay. Within this namespace, I want this monkey patch to apply.
Okay.
But, you know, everywhere else it doesn't apply, which is interesting because you could potentially have, you know, the same – like you could define for – you know, within this module, I want this method to do this. But within this module, I want this method to do something completely different, you know.
Right.
So that's a whole other issue. But so basically what it gives you is a little bit of safety with monkey patching. So you're explicitly enabling, you know, this – some sort of monkey patch in a specific scope,
as opposed to the bowels of your entire framework and exactly. platform.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that's a good thing.
Well, and I also like I can see here you when you define the class, there's like this using saying, I want this particular module or this patch in this class to apply to when I'm dealing with fixnums.
Exactly.
So that's really cool.
It's really cool, except if you dig really deep, Charles Nutter has a great follow up to this. You know, so Charles Nutter is in charge of JRuby.
Right.
I mean, he's Mr. JRuby. So,
yeah.
You know, it's a long, well-written, well-thought-out article, but I'll summarize if it's even possible. My apologies if I get this completely wrong. But, you know, the implementation is not simple.
I'm sure it's not.
Yeah. No. I mean, I know he's thinking of the Java implementation.
Yeah, because the bytecode in the VM and everything.
Well, I mean, that's not specifically the problem. Or is it not that level? But no, there's just all sorts of related issues. So, in short, I guess the proposal is that this refine would not be a keyword, but if it was, the implementation would be a lot easier. So now that there's a lot of extra checks that are going to have to be done now, basically whenever you do these includes. So, you know, there's, I guess, ongoing debate on the effect that this is going to have, because it could potentially globally have a negative effect on performance.
Okay.
So I guess that's under debate.
So I guess it's not nearly to the level, but to some level, like almost like closures in Java. There's big debates about how you want to implement it.
Well, the only difference is they're going to actually do
something. They're going to do it. Yeah,
I was gonna say, exactly.
The difference is you won't have to wait like 4 years.
Yeah. They'll at least decide something quickly.
Right.
You know, it's not like...
Come to some sort of understanding.
Exactly. There's no...
Yeah, it looks like a big long screed he has in there, but he's usually... I mean, I love reading his stuff. He's really smart.
No, it's his response to this is really well done.
Cool. So, yeah. I'll put that on my read it later. All right. Let's see. I had another one. And of course, I'm waiting for a reload. Okay. So I'm going to go with Matt Rabel.
Mm-hmm.
Matt's a friend of Chariot at one point. I know we had him out at ETE a while back, maybe 2008 before, 2007 before I came. And he gave a kind of web frameworks comparison talk, if I remember even back then. He's the guy, if you're a Java developer, who created AppFuse, which was kind of like, and probably still is, kind of like a application
templating system
written in a ton of different platforms, from Scala to you know, to anything, you know, Wicket and Spring and Hibernate and Seam, you name it. So he, because of all this time he's spending in these different frameworks, and because he's a consultant working in a number of different places, you know, he has in a nice, unique position of being able to compare them again. So he just did this at DevOx, and there's a nice post on RabelDesigns.com called My Comparing JVM Web Frameworks Presentation. And it's like a 50-some page presentation, but he's got some nice stuff in there, including a good spreadsheet matrix.
Mm-hmm.
He came up with, as I'm flipping through this, he came up with five frameworks he felt.
These are all JVM frameworks.
These are all...
They, I'm pretty sure they're all JVM frameworks.
Well, they might be, but I know it's at least Ruby on Rails is in there, so he's probably
thinking of JRuby. Yeah.
JRuby, yeah. Mm-hmm. So what he comes up with is that the top level scorers were, in his matrix, Spring MVC,
mm-hmm.
Google Web Toolkit,
mm-hmm.
Ruby on Rails, and they all had scored a 17 in his marker.
Well, there's two spreadsheets. So there's the one that's, I guess, the front page one, and then there's one that's weighted.
Okay. Maybe this is the waiting one.
Yeah, but they're not that far off.
Okay, right. Yeah. And then the fourth one was Grails at 16.5%, whatever number. And then Wicket, which is kind of interesting because I've heard a lot of roiling about, you know, people who like Wicket. I just never looked at it myself. And then Struts 2 is down there around where Wicket is. So those are the five that he kind of came up with. It's kind of the ones that to look at, I suppose, or at least scored higher. And then he goes into the pros and cons of each. So this is a really good reading. It's always good to see someone's opinions on these things, especially someone who's had to really kind of wrestle those frameworks enough to get to good use cases for each one, right? But, you know, he goes into kind of pros and cons of things like Spring MVC, Google Web Toolkit, Ruby on Rails, and again, Grails and Wicket. And then he starts comparing, you know, things like the performance of some of these frameworks based on what he observed. And I'm sure he documents how he does this. Be interesting to see what his metrics are all based on.
Yeah, so they're interesting. I mean, I guess he breaks it down by developer productivity, perception, learning curve, project health, developer availability, which is interesting.
Yeah.
Job trends.
Yes.
Templating, components, Ajax. There's just a scalability. There's a good, 20-something categories?
Yeah, like on page 44 even, it's very interesting that you look at the Stack Overflow tagged questions, right, where people tag their questions, and you look at any of these statistics to see what's going on. But if you just look at the volume of questions around Rails, now I don't necessarily know that that means that Rails is more popular, or the people had more questions about it, or more confused, or just there was a lot of good activity. I don't know, but
right.
They had 22,000 questions for.
It's
for
not even Rails. Close, is it?
It's hugely tiny. Well, hugely tiny. It's not even a word. It's extremely tiny. It probably isn't even close to 3,000 questions or 2,000 questions on Grails and Spring MVC and whatever the other one is on that matrix. So you have to wonder, like, what are some of these things? Right? It's great, but
I spend a lot of time in the Rails community.
Yeah,
and I'm on a lot of those Stack Overflow pages.
Right,
a lot of those questions are mine. But
so you're 21,000.
No, and I can honestly say, I mean, my general feeling is that they're not questions posted out of an abundance of complexity or a dearth of documentation.
Right,
you know, I mean, there is some of that, but I mean. It's sort of in between, like mm-hmm. legitimate,
like enthusiasts trying to get.
You know what?
Stuff
a lot of
done.
Them, a lot of them are like noob questions,
right?
So I don't know how that plays into it,
right? And the other thing is, I don't know if he then went, for example, with Spring, they've got a huge number of forums on their own website,
right?
And that's very trafficked.
Well, that could be it because I think Stack Overflow is probably the de facto destination for Rails developers.
That makes sense.
To go for questions. I mean, mm-hmm. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. But I mean, if it's not de facto, it's certainly one of the top set.
Well, so let me throw it around. So all right, we got 25,000 questions, roughly right. 23,000 or something.
Right.
And then the next slide. I love these things. I love looking at stats because you can look at things so many different ways. And then he has the next slide tag questions on language.
Right.
And you know what got the most questions? Almost 80,000 questions on Java in terms of language.
Are these date constrained? Is this like within the last year or so?
I really would love to know what his...
Because a lot of those can be from like 1999.
Yeah, it could have been, right? I'm not sure.
How do I get my applet to launch?
It's a tag questions as of October 28th, 2010. So maybe it is like, you know,
cumulative?
From inception. Yeah. I don't know. But it's funny because you look at that and the rest of them look like disks on the ground compared to that. I'm looking here. It looks like Scala and Groovy get the next highest, but they're like a quarter compared to a roll of quarters
in the
graph. But anyway, it's really interesting to see. And again, like you said, he went into job prospects and the growth. And, you know, Rails has had this steady growth over time,
right?
According to his analysis. And it's, you know, you've seen it. And then you've got different curves for others, but Rails is still pretty well up there, for example. So I don't know. I always like looking at these things, not like I would be swayed by how many developers are in a community versus what fits for you. In fact, he's basically saying pick the ones you think make the most sense and then do like a 1 week spike or iteration with each trying the same application, then see which ones meet your criteria and work for you, which is absolutely what you should be doing.
Right.
You know, as opposed to saying, oh, this is the most popular, I'm just gonna go with it. Well, depends on your developer skills and what kind of people you have in your organization. Does it really do things that you want to do well? You know, that kind of thing. So, but I don't know. I find it good reading, interesting reading.
Definitely.
For debate.
Yeah.
So that's that.
He's certainly got some courage.
Yeah.
I would never do this.
I would love, yeah, exactly. Please duck your head now while the missiles fly over your head.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, okay. So anyway, so that's up on rabledesigns.com and check the comments. I'm sure at the end of that should be very interesting. I know he just put it out there a couple days ago. So. You have one more here. You have something on App Engine.
Yeah, so there's a new App Engine release, and the latest release they've introduced, they're calling the Channel API. So it's a new set of API. Well, it's actually two methods. But it's a new API.
Set of is more than one. You're good.
Well, so basically it allows you to create a persistent connection between your app and you know, the Google servers and a client, a JavaScript client.
Okay.
So you know... I can't say it's Comet, and I can't say it's WebSockets. It's some Google hybrid
that,
you know, supposedly, you know, reliable over different clients and different JavaScript engines and things like that. So it's actually – it seems ridiculously easy to be able to, you know, do anything sort of real-time chat systems or, you know, any kind of real-time messaging. So, you know, obviously polling is to be avoided, you know, when possible.
Right.
Clearly. So for lots of different reasons. But so they make it easy. And I think the back end of it is actually implemented over Google's XMPP.
That's what it says right here. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Stuff. So it's, you know, some of the Google Talk technology involved in this. So
that's good.
It's actually very cool. So it's not like a two-way WebSocket thing. So honestly, I don't know if the JavaScript client – well,
Yeah, whether polls or registers for the event, like who knows? Yeah.
So the examples that I've seen, and I still need to get into this a little more, but you know, you still make regular AJAX requests to do things like sort of register with the API. You have to supply a client ID, which could be like your username or whatever session ID you're using, or you know, whatever you want to do.
Some way to get back to you.
Yeah, and your client gets a token, and once it grabs onto that token, I think it's valid for like 2 hours or something like that.
Wow.
So, you know, once you have that token, then you can go ahead and just use this channel API. It seems really cool.
Yeah, they say in here that basically everything's hidden from the developer. Whatever they're doing, you don't really have to worry about the hood of it. You know,
yeah, I mean, who knows? I mean, maybe on browsers that support it, it'll HTML5 WebSockets are being used. I have no idea. So it's sort of Comet-like. I don't know if it actually uses Comet as a protocol.
Yeah,
But
that's interesting.
It doesn't, yeah.
Yeah, they say in here it doesn't use WebSockets, but the API is compatible with it.
Oh, okay.
Kind of. Yeah, it's designed to match the W3C WebSockets standard, so the app developers who adopt channels will eventually be able to transition to a WebSockets-based version.
Oh, I see.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah, it's very cool. So, you know, you get all the goodness of WebSockets over, you know, across a browser or JavaScript client-compatible way, and you're good to go.
Now, I haven't been keeping up with App Engine one. So how has it been evolving? I know there's now like the public versus the hosted company mode, right? Where from what I read, the hosted company mode gives you a real relational database, but you have to pay per seat. Like, what's going on with that?
Yeah, I don't know. I have mixed feelings about it. I mm-hmm. honestly, I haven't read any feedback from anybody who's been using it.
You mean the app, the company?
The App Engine for Business.
Right.
But it's just interesting that they've finally thrown in the towel and given up and said, look, well, I guess they gave up a year ago, right?
Not everyone's going to do the weird databases of the
yeah. So the thing is, you know, if you're going to use App Engine and you're going to go Bigtable, you know, they do everything like they're such engineers. Everything,
yes.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
Anybody else could see this coming, you know? If I want to write like something at Facebook scale, okay,
right.
I want Bigtable. You need Bigtable.
Mm-hmm.
So if you got something that's going to go viral or at gigantic scale, you need that. Everything else, Heroku or Jenga or any of those guys,
Or hell, EC2 with a server. Just throw it up there. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I can write any Rails app, almost a plain vanilla Rails app, push it to Heroku, and you've got
– It's done.
It's done.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you've got the scalability of App Engine, and you don't have to watch
– But it's a relational database, right? But was it MySQL behind the scenes? Or
I think it's
like
Postgres.
That?
But okay. You can do MySQL. You can actually do Mongo
I'm
with it. You
Postgres.
Can do you
yeah.
can do Couch.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know
– So you don't have the restrictions you do on App Engine public.
You don't have the restrictions. Now, you know, it's going to be a little harder if you've got some, Words with Friends type app that needs to scale out the wazoo.
Right.
I mean, that's perfect for App Engine. But I mean, from a business perspective, I'm not quite sure what they were trying to do.
Right.
You know, so not everybody is writing some crazy Scrabble game that everyone's going to use.
Right.
So.
And yet, you know, I think that's probably where a lot of those things are, like a lot of the public facing ones. What was I looking at recently that was using apps? Oh, there's a nice outliner tool for the iPad.
Right.
Called CF Outliner. And you actually, when you go to share your outlines with yourself on the computer or whatever, it goes to an AppSpot site. So it's going to a Google App Engine.
I mean, really,
that kind of thing. You know, it's like document attachments. It's probably using like Couch or something like that to store them. I don't know.
Well, I mean, personally, I really like App Engine myself.
Yeah.
But
it's business wise.
I just don't understand how they expect. I don't understand their marketing efforts behind it and what they were thinking.
Well, I think that you're right. The engineering side of it, and of course, now we're all going to get shot from Google. But it's not negative. You're right. They're engineer focused. So even with things like Wave, Wave comes out. It's really, really technically dense, right?
Exactly.
You look at it, you're like, wow. I think I understand what they're trying to do,
right?
But I don't see how anyone's going to adopt it instead of email, instead of messaging, because it was parts of everything else you might use,
right?
But not in one unit that you could pick up and say, I absolutely understand why I want to use it.
Yeah. So, I mean, they're kind of reacting now and they're saying, well, we'll give you a SQL backend. You want a SQL backend? So, I mean, maybe that's the answer for them. Maybe maybe that's the big hang up that people have.
I think they're brilliant engineers there.
Oh, yes.
And, I'm even looking, for example, I'm doing the Ruin Action book. Right now I'm working on the RIA chapter, right? So I'm working on that, and they just released the GWT integration. So you literally can go in and say, from the root command line, git setup.
Mm-hmm.
And it spits out configures, you know, Maven and configures everything and sets up the Qt compiler, and now everything scaffolds automatically. And they're using the newer, there's like a newer version of the user interface design that they're calling MVP, mm-hmm. Model View Presenter. And then there's this whole event bus system. And you could tell it's really engineered, right? There's a lot of pieces that work together, and it looks like it's a really well put together engineering effort, but there's a lot of classes. So it's one of those things where I look at it and go, wow, there's a lot to digest here. Clearly they're thinking about all the different pieces, but it's a lot of engineering.
Yeah, I mean, I see these debates where, you know, people complain about things that they have to do differently. Basically, if you write an App Engine app, you know, you have to pay a lot more attention to optimizing your app, to doing things that it kind of forces good practices.
Right.
You know what I mean?
It's not all bad.
It forces you to think about caching. It forces right. you to denormalize, you know, where it makes
for
sense.
For performance, because you yeah. are going to have to put it on a scalable yeah. system that can't be relational.
Right. And App Engine defenders, and, you know, I kind of count myself as one of them, would definitely say, well, so what's wrong with that? You should be doing this anyway.
Right.
You know, you should be thinking like you're working with Bigtable, you know? Mm-hmm. But the bottom line is sometimes people just don't want to do that. You
right.
know, sometimes I just want to throw up my time tracking app. And, I, you know, so it
makes and not every app needs the scale like that.
Yeah, so
and
it makes a couple extra queries. You know.
Yeah, I have the same – it's funny. I have the same debate with myself about things like Mongo and Cassandra and all these NoSQL databases. For a regular business app where they end up having to report against them, do other stuff, it's not always as practical. But I don't think anyone now is thinking of do the whole app in a NoSQL DB.
We'll save that debate for another time.
Yes, because you want to talk about.
I want to talk about Mongo.
Yeah, well, we're gonna have Eric on the show specifically to talk about MongoDB.
I think it's a lot more practical than you think.
Okay, you don't need to convince me, but let's try.
Okay.
All right. Cool. Well, that was a good set of debates. It'll tick off most people that we work with.
Sure. Why not?
All right. Well, if you have any questions about the show, if you want to post comments, you can hit us on Twitter at TechCast. I'm actually at KRimple on Twitter if you want to send me a private message. Are you on Twitter these days?
Time to Code, TIME right. number 2 code.
I love that one.
Yeah.
And so you can do that. If you want to find out about Chariot services, including training and consulting and other things, we're at chariotsolutions.com. And we actually have Philly Emerging Tech coming up for 2011. We've been in the planning stages. It's going to happen late in April. So look for an announcement for that soon. And you'll start seeing at some point a website, I think by the beginning of the year, sometime early
something
in the
like
year.
That.
Yeah. That's going to announce what our agenda is and who our speakers are. But we're definitely planning that, so stay tuned for that. All right. So for the Dev News, I'm Ken Rimple.
I'm Eric Snyder.
And we'll see you next time.